This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington's Downtown Task Force has finished its final report.
Our job was not to come up with new ideas necessarily or to come up with something different. It was to come up with a specific strategy to integrate and implement the plans we already have.
Hear from Task Force Chair Amelia Burgess. Plus, the final document didn't pass unanimously. As well, we'll hear from Laura Kennedy about a new ISU history. And a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Downtown Task Force in Bloomington has issued its final report and voted 5-1 to forward it to the City Council a couple months ahead of the original deadline. The document includes near-term and long-term elements. Task Force Chair and Alderman Amelia Burgess focuses first on the lowest of low-hanging fruit, things that can be done fast to improve the economic climate and encourage activity in the downtown.
I think that's what's the most exciting portion of the task force's work, is this notion that there are so many things we can do in the downtown area in the short term that will have a meaningful impact, and it'll be things that residents will notice. And some of those are consistent with what we've already done in the downtown area, so beautification and public art, looking at ways we can expand that. Also talking about walkability. How do we make it more pleasant for people who currently visit downtown to expand from just going to a single business to walking around the area and checking things out?
How much do you think that those things will run?
They can vary in cost depending on what of the different recommendations the council might look at. So I'll give you an example. One area we've looked at that touches on all three of those points, walkability, public art, as well as public safety, is ways to improve public crosswalks. And if you're looking for the less expensive option that still has a meaningful impact, you can use artwork in the crosswalks. There are a lot of different examples of ways that people can make decorative painted crosswalks. And comparatively, that is a very low cost. Now, if you wanted to look and explore a more permanent, more costly option, many communities use brick crosswalks. And I think that that's something that residents or a proposal that would really resonate with a lot of residents who want to continue to see the downtown area honor its historic past. In terms of actually pricing out any recommendations, that was beyond the task force's, really, its authority. We were looking more at prioritization and pulling things out of our documents. So any of the proposals contained in there will need to go through a feasibility stage if the council wants to take them up and look at them further.
There have been tons of studies, tons of plans, tons of recommendations over decades, and portions of them tend to get done sporadically, incompletely. And while no urban design plan should be expected to be done 100%, the track record is perhaps a little less than satisfying. What is going to make this one different?
Correct. And this is not just a Bloomington problem. I was reading an article the other day that something like 90% of comprehensive plans are never implemented fully. And that may vary in level, and it may vary in different reasons. I mean, conditions change over time. For example, our Bloomington Comprehensive Plan goes through 2035. Things will change, and we need to be responsive to that. So what's exciting to me about the task force is our job was not to come up with new ideas necessarily or to come up with something different. It was to come up with a specific strategy to integrate and implement the plans we already have. And I think that's a key there, and that will allow us to be successful in a very organized, intentional way.
Map that out for the council, assuming that this gets adopted.
Sure. So the task force report actually has several different sections, and each section starts with an introductory paragraph, and then it actually has quotations from the different plans. showing where these ideas came from and why they're being brought up. And then we have the actual recommendations, which in most instances are one or two sentences. We were all about keeping this very simple and leaving it open for further conversation.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Amelia Burgess, the chair of the Downtown Task Force. Of course, a lot of attention has gone to the so-called Catalyst projects. You're recommending three potential ones. What are they?
Correct. And we split them up into tiers. So we have a tier one, which is what we recommend should be explored first. But then we also recognize that there are many opportunities in the downtown area. We found out through this process that in the expanded downtown area, we have 29 developable acres. So there is so much potential. And much of that may depend on changing conditions, what opportunities arise, but that tier one is really looking at a property in downtown Bloomington that we are going to have to deal with as a city, and that's the Market Street Garage. It is nearing the end of its useful lifespan. To extend that lifespan somewhat, we're going to have to invest a significant amount of money. So the task force on the whole said, okay, well, let's focus on that area. Not only do we have to deal with it, but it is one of the largest blocks in that core of downtown, and it has enormous potential to really transform that area, to take it from what most people would say is, you know, a necessary structure, but not one that is contributing to the environment or to the walkability or to the historic nature of downtown. And how do we re-envision that? And then the task force started looking at what are the potential partnerships, what projects are underway, what do the specific plans say we should look at. And so that, at the end of the day, that recommendation starts with replacing the parking, which is necessary in downtown, and then looking at a partnership with Connect Transit for a transfer station, and then also recommending that the City Council explore the feasibility of moving the public library and really look at the potential benefits of doing that in that area.
How should that considered look be processed? The Mayor Renner has said it's time for the conversation. Alderman Schmidt said if there is to be a conversation, it needs to happen quickly, but feasibility studies by their nature are not necessarily quick. What happens now with a process that will create an eventual consensus?
Sure. Well, I think first and foremost, we need to present this to the council, allow them some amount of time to digest it, look at where those recommendations came from, and to understand why we've come to this conclusion, which I think to many people was not what they expected to come out of the task force, and I understand that. So we need to continue that conversation. And then it's a matter of looking at and getting answers to some of those questions. Right? How many square feet will we have to work with? What would a potential structure look like? Those kinds of conceptual plans can be drawn up relatively quickly if there is a desire to do so. And then, of course, you have to go down the road about, okay, if we are interested, where is the potential funding coming from? What does that look like? So this is not something where we would be ready to build a project within the next year, but we can do a lot of work within the next year.
The vote to accept the final draft of the report and to forward it to the council was 5-1. Alderman Kim Bray, as I understand it, voted against, saying that she might even prefer an east side library. She doesn't think there's a consensus to put a library downtown. Given the nature of libraries and the affinity that various constituencies have for them and the desire they have for them in various parts of town, is consensus on this Catalyst project even possible?
I think that it is, and I think it is reflected in our comprehensive plan. It talks extensively about how you place projects that benefit the entire community and the different considerations that go into that. So it's accessibility to public transit, for example. And I think that if you look through the language in those documents, it makes a strong case for, first, we need to focus on a fully productive, functional, central library. And then I think that we as a council do need to have continuing conversations about, is that sufficient within our community? Are we best serving all of our residents that way? But I think it's really difficult to get to that second portion of that conversation until we have an adequate facility with a centralized main library. It's just too difficult, in my opinion, to assess what our true community needs are until we get to a position where we can assess what a fully functioning Central Library looks like.
That's your Tier 1 project. Your Tier 2 is a hotel. Tier 3 is a mixed-use building. What went into the calculation of those priority rankings? Why Tier 2, the hotel, instead of Tier 2, the mixed-use building? Or why Tier 3, mixed-use, instead of whatever?
Sure. And I think to some extent it's a judgment call. I think any of these recommendations, if the opportunity arises, that the council should not hesitate to fully explore them, whether they're Tier 1, Tier 2, or Tier 3. And especially with the Tier 2 and Tier 3, I think additional information could easily change the ranking. But the reason I think that Tier 2 is the hotel conference center conversation is because the recommendation in the downtown strategy plan was so very strong there. I mean, it very explicitly said this needs to be explored. But of course, we know that will depend on market conditions, opportunities. Council has explored some different opportunities in the last several years with regard to a hotel, and we haven't found the right fit. So I think there's a little bit of hesitation there about whether or not we will find that right spot for that type of project. Now, with the mixed-use redevelopment, that's based more on this notion of we don't want to compete with the private market, and we don't want to incentivize projects that can stand alone. So it's based on the realization that when it comes to mixed-use retail and housing, that to the extent that we can create more demand in the downtown area by bringing more people in, those projects will need less public support. So it's a kind of a pragmatic decision there, even though we also wanted to make clear that there are really good opportunities there for development in that area.
Alderman and Downtown Task Force Chair Amelia Burgess says she encourages the public to review the document and give the City Council feedback as the Council decides which projects to advance. When the task force was taking public comment, Burgess says she was struck by the keen interest in revitalizing the downtown. As a matter of disclosure, GLT Program Director Mike McCurdy is the chair of the Connect Transit Board involved in that potential Catalyst Project. You can read the task force report at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Mid-Illini Credit Union, where different is better. A full-service, nonprofit, member-owned financial cooperative with locations on Eastland Drive and now inside the Mount Pisgah Baptist Church on Market Street. Always open at midillinicu.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A president that guided the country through the university through its darkest hour, a far-reaching educational philosophy, a university leader who was a bit of a scoundrel. The history of Illinois State University is full of unique and little-known stories. Laura Kennedy has more with the author of a new book that digs deep into the university's past and uncovers heroes, scalawags, and a governor with a soft spot for castles.
April Carlene Anderson spends her days literally surrounded by the history of ISU. As university archivist, she has access to items great and small pertaining to the one-time teacher's college, now university. Anderson says she was surprised that no one in the 160-year history of ISU had actually penned a book about the university. So she did it herself. Put out by Arcadia Publishing, the new book is part of a nationwide campus history series. Anderson explained she wanted to give alumni, students, and the community a chance to learn about the campus. She traced a variety of tales about early days of the university, including the influence of an educational philosophy known as Herbartianism, which was introduced by educator Charles DeGarmo.
It is actually a German-based educational philosophy that was started around the 1830s in Germany. Charles DeGarmo, when he was a student, decided he was going to go to Jena, Germany, and learn this philosophy, and he brought it back to the United States and brought it back directly to Illinois State, which is where this form of pedagogy known as Herbartianism was found. It became known as American Herbartianism, and the five founders of this Herbartianism movement, which was Charles DeGarmo, there's three McMurrays. There's Lyda McMurray, Charles McMurray, and Frank McMurray.
Not Fred McMurray?
Yeah, no, God, see, you're throwing me.
Sorry.
So many names. And Cecil Van Loo. They were all here in the 1890s. And with John Cook, they developed and blossomed this form of pedagogy that became the pedagogy taught in the United States. It was all the normal schools were teaching it. It was started and founded here. There was even a national organization known as the American Herbartianism. We were that founding educational philosophy that's taught. And elements of that are still found in education, that if you go to a school today, you still see elements of that philosophy in schools. So we founded that here.
Could you give me an example of the philosophy?
Sure. So in a nutshell, if you think of it as developing a moral character. So if you have a small child and you have them in their class and you want to teach them about being an upstanding citizen, you teach them about Charles Hovey and how Charles Hovey, with the students who were on campus and they were all trying to go to the Civil War and they wanted to fight in the Civil War, he says, no, 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 I'll join with you if you get that degree. He got permission to have the 33rd Illinois from Abraham Lincoln. They all joined up together once they got their degrees and they went off to fight in battle. That's an upstanding citizen if you've ever seen one. And if you teach children about these amazing people in history, they too in turn will want to be moral citizens. And so you're creating a moral citizen to be part of our community and our larger community. So you still see some of that in education today, teaching people about morality and also repetitiveness. So you go to say third and fourth and fifth grade and you're learning the same math you learned from your previous year, but they're tacking on a little extra. And that was also found in Herbartianism. So you do see small elements of Herbartianism in today's education.
And I guess it's no coincidence that the education building mm-hmm. on the ISU campus was named for Charles DeGarmo.
Exactly. That was purposely done.
Well, you just mentioned Lincoln. Could you tell us a bit about Lincoln's association with Illinois State University?
Oh, sure. So Lincoln and Jesse Fell, I like to use them as the example and then mesh them together with modern day roommate examples. They were paired together in Vandalia. They were randomly paired together to be roommates when they were both lawyers, got to know each other, found that they had similar interests, and they became lifelong friends. And if it weren't for Jesse Fell, Abraham Lincoln would never have run for president, and he wouldn't have been our 16th president. So Jesse Fell had a huge influence on Lincoln becoming president in the United States. So when Jesse Fell was founding the university here, he asked Lincoln to be the attorney, if you will, to create the bond of sale documents that citizens, when they were donating money and building up the money to buy the land and purchase the land in North Bloomington, Abraham Lincoln was the attorney for the Board of Education at the time. But Lincoln was, at Jesse Fell's request, here for him and got those documents put together, and that's how we got our university.
It's wonderful that on campus we have the Jesse Fell gates mm-hmm. on the east side of the campus, and then on the west side of the campus we have the Lincoln gates. They're opposite each other. So they're still sort of united in a way on campus.
Oh, yeah, actually, I've never thought of it that way, to be honest. They link each other together. So, yeah, and I think that they're, I hate for a better lack of a, I like to think it's like a buddy cop movie. they're just, I've always in my mind held them together as the best of friends. And it's just like students today getting randomly paired up in a room. You never know what kind of friendships you're going to find when you come to school and, you know, and want to better the world. And that's exactly what they were doing. And they became the best of friends.
Well, Fell Hall actually used to be a place where students would be paired up because it was a dormitory at one point, and you have photographs of the rooms in the book. That was pretty spacious for a dorm room.
My gosh, for what I say, $6.25 a week? For $6+ a week, you got some swanky digs. Yeah, I mean, you got the nice bedding and the furniture that was in the room. You got meals. I mean, Fell Hall was the first dormitory on campus. We did not have dormitories prior to that. Students were required to find their own housing, and they most often lived with their own professors in town or with locals in town who had boarding facilities. So you'd have professors here who were teaching and then on the side making a little extra money and let students live in their homes. They being administration at the time, had been trying to have a dormitory for decades, and it just, funding being what it was, they just never could secure the money until around 1918, when they did secure the money, built the first dormitory named for Jesse Fell, and it became the first women's dormitory on campus.
One of the most striking buildings on campus is Cook Hall. It's very easy if you tell somebody who's never been to the Illinois State University campus, well, just look for the big castle. How on earth did we end up with a castle on the Quad?
Well, there was a governor. The Alfged Castles. There was a governor who was very fond of that architecture. So five state universities have one of these styled buildings that are on this campus. The rumor is, and I say rumor because I've not been able to prove it yet, I've heard lots of people tell me that if you were to take the building plans, the footprints of all of these five castles and put them together, it will make one giant castle. And my first question would be, why? And then my second, why would we do this? And then my second question is, prove it. And I have not been able to prove that yet. But that's right. If you say, look for the castle, everybody knows where that castle is. And that is our oldest building currently on campus.
The buildings on campus are named for former presidents. We have Hovey and so forth, the past important people associated with Illinois State University. But there was a president who wasn't president for very long, and that was President Brown. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a bit about him?
Well, he has a little bit of a sordid history. So Brown was only here for about 3 years, but when he was here, started in 30, the university was on the brink of closure. And by closure, I mean closing down, never opening again closure. We were in danger both financially, but also in losing our accreditation. So he took it upon himself to do this reconstruction, if you will, of our administrative system within the campus and develop this idea of departments. So instead of coming to school here and just taking some courses that would lead to your degree, you'd actually have a department that you could focus in. Say, if you were a part of the speech department, that included theater, that you could go in that direction with your education. You were still getting a teaching degree, but you were focusing your teaching degree in a particular direction, as well as taking the gen ed courses. So he saved the university by helping develop these academic departments. But at the same time, he may have had a little something-something on the side with a lady friend. The rumor was, and I'm pretty sure this was the case, he brought with him from Oshkosh, Wisconsin, a woman who was his secretary, but he forged her certifications that she had a teaching certificate when she actually did not have a teaching certificate. He forged a lot of these documents for her to come here and work for him, and then she started firing longtime faculty. When faculty found out about her non-credentials, they put together a committee and we're going to kick him out. And he ended up resigning and leaving almost in the middle of the night, actually. He turned in his resignation to the Teachers College Board and left. Of all of my presidential portraits, he is the only one I do not have a presidential. Well, no, actually, there's two that I don't have a presidential portrait for. But he is one of them that I do not have one for.
Because he wasn't long enough here to get one.
Well, he was here long enough to have a portrait. The joke is that he maybe took it with him in the middle of the night, but we've not been able to locate it. If there was one that was created, we can't prove that there was one created, and even if there was one created, we can't find it. He's one of our more colorful presidents in history.
That's April Carlene Anderson, archivist for Illinois State University. Her new book about the history of ISU is out right now from Arcadia Publishing. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see a photo of author April Carlene Anderson along with acclaimed actor and ISU graduate Gary Cole, who brandished the saber of ISU President Charles Hovey, on our website, wglt.org.
NPR's Don Gagne knows what questions to ask to help you understand current issues.
The NRA got its voters out in large.
McCain said his vote today is only to allow debate on the health care bill.
The Senate Judiciary Committee wants very much to talk to Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort.
Coming up November 10th, Don Gagne returns to GLT's Radio Faces, and it's your turn to ask questions of the experienced newsman. Learn more at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, GLT's grow. The Keene family has been very good to Illinois State University athletics the last 4 years, not from a monetary standpoint, but on the football field and the volleyball court. The brother and sister duo of Dalton and Jalen Keene have been all-conference performers in their respective sports and helped lead their teams to Missouri Valley Conference titles along the way. There is 15 months difference in their age. Dalton is the oldest, but sat out a redshirt season as a freshman. Both are in their senior seasons. Their mom, Rose, along with Dalton and Jalen, talked about their athletic adventures while growing up and at ISU with GLT's Brian Bloodworth. Rose Keene says the two have always been competitive.
Very competitive. In fact, growing up, the household was very competitive. To get them to bed at night, we would run up the stairs and see who could get there first, you know. Everything was competitive.
I take it they're also very close to each other.
They are. They really support each other. I think part of it being good is that one's a boy and one's a girl. So they didn't have to compete on the field and follow in anybody's footsteps, you know, as far as doing their athletics. It wasn't boy against boy. It wasn't girl against girl. And so I got to live up to my sister's expectations, or I got to live up to my brother's expectations. Being of the opposite gender, I think, was a real positive there.
Did they get on each other when they play, as far as, you know, hey, come on, suck it up, you got to play, or, you know, you're better than that? Or,
well, they kind of knew what the other could do, and they just have been ones that push themselves. They've just had, like you talked about, that inner drive earlier. That's something that we really haven't had to do. My thing was always just do the best you can, you know, and if you're injured or hurt or sick, just do what you can. We know you won't be able to do, you know, 110%, but just do what you can. And I don't know, they kind of took that to heart in everything, you know, in their studies as well as their athletics. And knock on wood, they've been two just awesome kids.
Are they a lot alike or a lot different?
Well, they definitely have their differences. I think Jalen will work her tail off in anything. Dalton sometimes will cruise through just enough to get by with what, you know, okay, he wants the A. Jalen's not happy unless she can get the A+. Probably the biggest difference, I'd say.
What about the challenges as a parent of getting to both people's events? How do you do that now? How'd you do it earlier and when they're in high school and that type of thing?
It is very difficult because with them in high school, they were in sports all year long until, of course, spring. Jalen was in soccer, and then Dalton would be working out. When mom and dad were together, we would split. One would go one would go to the other. And in college, it's a little bit of the same, but we don't communicate as well. So sometimes both are at one game. You go to what you can, like in college, local, Bloomington, I try to get to as much as I can. So it's kind of hit and miss. I feel bad. I wish I could be at everything. But since they're in the same season, that makes it tough. So if one had been winter and one had been fall, that would have been super. Could have been to everything. We do the best they can, and they understand. So that's the good thing.
Obviously, you got to be very proud to have two kids in the Division I programs playing, you know, at the Division I level.
You are so right. I am a very proud mama. They've done a great job, both academically as well as and their sport.
Okay, that's mom's insight to Dalton and Jalen. What's theirs?
So who's more competitive?
Him.
I'd say both of us are. I don't know who has a step up, because it all, I mean, we started playing in our backyard, and I would always play left-handed because she'd get mad if I played right-handed. We played basketball or something like that. And then the times I tried to play sand volleyball, it was always back and forth because she never said it, but I knew this is my sport, is what she was trying to get across. You know, you have yours, you stay with yours, and I'll do mine. It was an unwritten code that I figured out very fast, because you start blinking, she starts hitting the ball on the ground, and you can't see it. So definitely props to you on that. But I would say the competitiveness is different depending on, like, obviously we play way different sports, but I see the same drive that I have when I play in her, and there's times when she goes far beyond what I've done.
Yeah, I would say that we've been pretty competitive, like, throughout our years, like, when we lived together at home, and Especially like when we would play a sport like against each other. Like he said, we played in the backyard like so many different like sports. We played soccer, soccer and basketball were pretty much the sports that we could kind of compete against each other like fairly, I would say. But we never really played volleyball that much, and football, if anything, it was just like throwing it. It wasn't like anything like that, but there was always like that competitiveness. It was like, oh, I scored on you today, or he dunked on me, or
it'd be a little competitive. Maybe going, like, I remember when we were younger and going to South School, like our elementary school, you know, we try to race so you get there first, but you know, it's just little things like that. You're always going to try to get ahead of one another, and I think that kind of helped us, you know, as we have grown up, that you know, we still have the competitive fire, obviously, for each of our individual sports, but you never want to be last in anything, and that's definitely something that I've learned personally through like just playing football here under Coach Back, Coach Nowinski, and everything like that. You know, they strive for, you know, you want to be the best, and like that's, you know, said to you as a small kid and everything, but it was really, you know, kind of full force, you know, enforced here and at Illinois State, and I can't be more appreciative to them for that.
So you think that competitiveness made you the athlete that you are today?
Yeah, I would say that it definitely helped. If we didn't have that competitive edge, even like individually, if we didn't have that, I don't think we would be as far as we are right now and being as successful as we are. So I think that really did help in the long run.
You're listening to Sound Ideas with Brian Bloodworth, who is talking with ISU seniors Dalton and Jalen Keene about their athletic careers as Redbirds. Is there ever a point where you guys have become jealous of one another and their successes?
Probably more towards me on that one. I get told occasionally, more like a lot, that best athlete in the family is my little sister, you know. And whether that's true or not, we'll figure that out one day, but I always most of the time agree to it because she is, you know, she moves very well for how tall she is. She's pretty tall for a girl. You know, she's extremely athletic. She's strong. She can bounce back from a lot of injuries and stuff like that. Thankfully, she hasn't had many. Thankfully, I haven't had many. Yeah, knock on wood. But I remember when we were younger, we didn't want to go to each other's tournaments, soccer tournaments, stuff like that. We'd be gone every weekend, and then one weekend we'd get off. You know, the other one would have a tournament. I remember I just got to, I was a freshman in high school, and I didn't want to go back and watch her junior high, you know, volleyball games because I was like, that's beyond me. I'm in high school now. I don't want to go back and watch that. But by the time we both got to high school, I think we figured out that our relationship, you know, evolved a little bit. Like, we're always close. Yeah, we bickered a lot. Right now, I let her do her own thing. We communicate as much as we can. This year's been a little bit more difficult than the past couple of years have. You know, she's had road games. I've had road games. You know, schedules just aren't matching up like they have in previous years. But our relationship definitely, I think, has grown, you know, through the course of high school and then obviously now. And we're definitely a lot closer than we used to be. You know, most people wouldn't probably believe us saying that we were, you know, bickered unless you knew us back when we were younger. But for the most part, you know, I love her to death. I can't say a bad thing about her. You know, there's no bad blood. And if there was bad blood, it's just jealousy, if anything. And I don't think we have that anymore. You know, we're just glad, you know, we're at the same university. We're doing both being successful. And you couldn't ask for more than that. Like, your parents can come watch you. Both their kids are doing, you know, as well as they can. And we've both won. I've been a part of two conference championships. She's been a part of one. You know, that's something you can't, you know, may not be repeated, may not ever be repeated. But at the same time, we're still striving, you know, to be better than what we have been. And that competitive fire that, like I said, that they've, you know, instilled in us, and a little jealousy here and there, like, oh, she just won this, you know, last week, like player of the match or something like that. And, you know, I'm trying to go out and do the same thing, but at the same time, it's a different aspect because she's got six people on her team, you know, on the court at the time. We got 11, and I got to do my one, you know, 1/11th to help the whole team. And I know she does the exact same thing, her 1/6th. But, you know, we just do what we can to impact the game. And I think that's, you know, all we can do at this point. You know, she's a phenomenal athlete, and I couldn't be more happy for how she's developed in college and then how far she's come since, you know, playing outside in the backyard.
I don't know that I would give it all to me. I mean, that's the joke. I think it's kind of a joke, but kind of not at the same time. I mean, I wouldn't say that I'm the better athlete. I would say there's a close tie.
You guys coach each other or offer advice, critique?
I don't know much to say about volleyball. I mean, I know the basic rules, everything like that, as in what you guys do for, like, I wouldn't even know, is it formations and stuff like that? That's football terminology, but I know my dad's has little comments here and there. Mom has the same thing, but as for the most part, I'm just like, good job, played hard, you win some, you lose some. The tough losses, we're always there for each other. Just got to get back out there, and every once in a while there'd be a little, text message here or there, or I might call her, she might call me and be like, hey, keep your head up, it's just a game, you got to move on, play the next one, got to bounce back, go back to the drawing board and go back to practice and figure out what we did wrong, what we can do better. Just little things like that, I think, could keep us, a little bit, our spirits up, no matter how we play.
I would say the same thing. I mean, I don't necessarily know football that much. I knew his other position a little bit better because you could kind of tell if he did good or not because he either caught the ball or didn't catch it. But it's still nice to, see him do his thing in the middle, and I just know that he's doing his thing no matter what situation it is, and it's just good to see that.
Well, it's a unique situation that a brother and sister at the same university and having standout careers. Do you ever stop and think about that?
Not really a lot. I know the only times I really do think about it are when people bring it up and think that they're always like, oh, you're at the same university as your brother. Did you pick that because he was there? And it's like, no, we picked it because it was the best fit for us. And it ended up being great that we were at the same university. But, I just think that it's really cool that we're at the same university. We get to see each other more times than we would if we weren't. And, I think that our choice to come here was definitely like one of our best choices for me. I know I can speak for myself, but just the atmosphere that we were given and the athletic opportunities and all that kind of stuff was really good.
Yeah, just to add to that, we couldn't have been more blessed. We ended up having offers from the same school, great coaches to come in and play for. Wouldn't say it's lucky, wouldn't say it's anything like that, but we were given the opportunity to come out and play, and we've both done what we were supposed to do. Maybe I never expected to be where I'm at right now, to be honest with you, because the position change kind of scared me a little bit. But great position coach, and Coach Nowinski took me through and basically held my hand through everything, and now I am where I am, and it's all because of him and all the other coaches. But I want to make it clear, she didn't follow me. She's here and she did her own thing. We have the same last name, but she has her own career. She has her own everything, from start to finish. She's done all this on her own. Yeah, I'm her brother in the background. That's fine. And yeah, she's my sister in the background. You can look on that all you want, but at the same time, we both have our own individual careers.
Dalton and Jalen Keene have been all-conference performers in their respective sports at ISU, and they were interviewed by Brian Bloodworth of GLT. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. After a long end to summer, autumn has finally arrived in central Illinois, bringing with it those gorgeous colors we all admire. Patrick Murphy gives us a look inside the leaves for the science of autumn colors in this edition of GLT's Grow.
Now is the time that the leaves are changing, giving us an array of fall colors. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field. From the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hi there, Murph.
Hello.
Today on GLT's Grow, Murph talks about the science of fall colors. I love science.
Science is cool, and fall color is even cooler.
All righty, dude.
There's so many things we love about fall. There's even a smell, I think, that you can think of when it comes to fall color. The rainy day when there's leaves laying all over the ground.
Yes, I love that.
That's a great smell.
It is.
But, when it comes to fall color, Laura, there's one primary contributor to the changing of the leaves, and that's the ratio of day to night, mm-hmm. or the hours of sunlight, right? And as they decrease, the trees... factories that are doing photosynthesis and the process of chemical chlorophyll, which makes the leaves green, it lessens. And then I'd like to give credit to a Nat Geo mm-hmm. program that I saw, and I even read the credits to try and find the fellow's name, but I couldn't do it. But he said something that I thought was brilliant about fall color.
What's that?
That's the trees showing you their real color is in the fall. Their real color.
Yes.
Because they're all green because of the photosynthesis and the chlorophyll on the leaves.
Uh-huh.
And there are lots of factors. You know, I think I've been in this career a long time, and myself and my colleagues and coworkers on and off during the years get asked the question, what are the fall colors going to do this year? And it's always kind of a guess, but there is some science behind it. So in addition to the decreasing hours of sunlight, there's also the decrease in photosynthesis, and the decreasing of night starts to help the abscission layer. That's where the leaf is attached to the branch.
Uh-huh.
It starts to weaken.
Oh, I see.
So you can have scenarios where, similar to the Midwest drought conditions that we have here, it's been hot and it's been dry. We've been long between rains since early summer.
Mm-hmm.
So there are going to be some trees that the leaves are not even turned yet. They're still a pale green, maybe
yes.
even a brownish color.
Yeah.
And you can see this in hackberry trees. They oftentimes have leaves that turn brown on the tree, and then they hit the ground. But you'll just as often find little clusters of leaves that are still green and yellow, where the little abscission has broken away from the stem, from the branch, and they've fallen to the ground. And you can also think of it in terms of the opposite situation for some genus of trees, like beech and oak in particular. That abscission layer takes all winter to break away. So uh-huh. that's when we enjoy the English oaks, for example. They can hold some of their leaves late into the season, and they're the color of a brown paper bag, which is still a color.
Yeah, it's a color.
It's
not, it's as, not very stunning.
It's not selected for jewelry.
It's not sugar
know.
Maple.
Yeah,
colorful.
there's no russet brown diamonds that I'm aware of, but there is chocolate in that color.
Actually, there are chocolate diamonds.
Yeah, they are, but they just...
They aren't as fun, though.
They're not as underwhelming.
Have...
But the beauty of those oak leaves and other trees that hold those leaves late is there's still some winter character there, and they offer a sound on a windy day, and it's a peaceful, wonderful sound, in my opinion. So in addition to that abscission layer deal taking place, there's some anthocyanins, which is a chemical that's associated with the red we see in everything from burning bush to black gum, tupelo, and they're produced in the fall. These anthocyanins, when the reduction of photosynthesis occurs,
mm-hmm.
and there are carotenoids, which bring us the orange and yellow colors. And then I mentioned the oak leaves that are oftentimes brown. There are tannins in those brown leaves, and you can even make your own stain if you're really cheap by soaking those leaves in water along with maybe some black walnuts, which are also heavy in those dark ebony-colored tannins.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, the science of fall colors. It's complicated.
There are lots of factors, you know. So mm-hmm. we have the hot and cool factors, you know, wet and dry factors, because the sunlight part still kind of stays the same,
mm-hmm.
you know. So a lot of times we see cases where we anticipate fall colors, and you'll see a tree that has a branch or branches within it that have already started to change color. And
yeah,
that can be attributed to fall color change a little bit, but that phenomenon is just as often as likely related to a stress factor.
Uh-huh.
And a stress factor could be the simple absence of rain and a little too much heat for late in the season. It's not you and I that just long for those cool days and nights. The trees do too. Cool season soils are when the roots do most of their growing. Not really related to fall color, however.
Okay.
So there are a couple scenarios we can kind of practice on, Laura. So we got the fall that we have here, and it's dry, and that can lead towards a intense but short-lived fall period,
mm-hmm.
fall colors period.
Right.
Where if it's wet but it's warm, you could have a dull but long-lasting fall color.
Okay.
All right. And then the opposites of that come along with it. So in many cases, if you see a whole bunch of trees changing early, then I think one could say the leaves are changing early.
All right.
But they're just changing. Whether they're changing early or not really is not the accurate way to look at it.
Okay.
If you were to take a calendar and write down and refer to it the next year, you would see that the fall color change happens pretty much at the same time every year.
Uh-huh.
And I think that we're a little bit distracted by the summer-like weather that still occurs in the fall for this year's scenario.
Yeah.
So what's the ideal thing for fall color is cool, wet weather.
Mm-hmm.
So the leaves, they'll go through their color change, and there'll be less of that noticeable stress. But whatever the combination of factors is, it always leads up to a day in November, And it's, I'm not going
like
to talk about Guns N' Roses. I'm not going
okay.
to Guns N' Roses.
Okay.
I want to.
But
I'm not going to go to Guns N' Roses. But we all know the day in November where it's like, oh, geez, I guess fall is here and I better bring in the hoses and stuff. And it's usually after that fall November thunderstorm and rainstorm. There might be some hail or some freezing rain involved. And that's also the day that Mother Nature literally physically knocks all the leaves off of the tree.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then they're all over the ground. And then if you're a gardener with a lawn, you're scratching your head saying, can I get one more mowing in? Can I chop those leaves up one more time? Because I had it looking so good before that storm came along.
Hey, Murph, I'm going to ask a question.
Yeah.
If you want to plant for interesting fall color, and if you get the really good, you know, perfect weather conditions, a lot of people tend to want to go for sugar maples because they give you a really beautiful color. But can you give us some different options if we want to have interesting fall color?
I would love to. For shade trees that are the size of the sugar maple, I always have to throw out the black gum. And
ooh,
also
yeah.
because my favorite college football teams, Redbirds and Roll Tide, they are red and white. So ISU, I think, would be a great place to have lots of black gums, and we do have them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to tell you, it's a glossy red, and it's beautiful, and it's deep. So I say burning bush and black gum because we all know the burning bush, which is a small foundation shrub.
Yes.
Unless you have one of the old-fashioned full-size jobbers.
We had one.
Yeah, they kind of go from, you know, a rosy red to a pink, you know, so you've got that. There are also oaks that I think have fantastic long-lasting gold color.
Like what?
Swamp white oak.
Mm-hmm.
And chinkapin oak.
Okay, that sounds good. Now, while we're talking about leaves, let's talk about next week, Murph.
The product.
Yes, to rake leaves or not to rake leaves. That's next week on GLT's Grow. If you've got a gardening question, we'd love to hear from you. Go to our website and submit it, wglt.org/grow.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois and New Jersey are in dire financial straits. They're competing for the title of worst fiscal health in the country. Some experts say there is hope, though. They point to California's long road to recovery from financial challenges. Illinois Issues reporter Daisy Contreras explores whether Illinois is on the right track to improve its condition.
Several years ago, Nancy Hudspeth studied the state's messy finances as an analyst for the University of Illinois. Looking back, she says the warning signs were always there.
At the time when I was doing the analysis, it was like, well, what's the future going to be like for me and my family? And we were doing these long-term projections, and it was like, oh my gosh.
Years later, the situation has worsened. A recent report published by the Mercatus Center, a research center based in Virginia, puts Illinois at 49 on the list of states with the worst fiscal health, and only New Jersey ranks lower. Experts say both states must truly address the issues of unpaid pension liabilities, as well as the growing backlog of other bills each has accumulated over the years. Eileen Norcross is a researcher with the Mercatus Center. She says Illinois' main problem is never having enough cash on hand to cover these expenses.
Consistently for the past few years, Illinois has had a very poor cash position. It's the same pattern of just struggle to get a budget in place and to meet short-term bills. This backlog of unpaid bills is certainly going to hurt in future rankings.
And New Jersey is facing the same struggles.
It's a very deep hole, and the consequences of getting out of it politically are very tough.
That's Gordon McInnes from the New Jersey policy perspective. He says New Jersey has hope since gubernatorial elections are later this year. And to address their fiscal issues, the state is looking to increase government contributions to pensions and retiree benefits. Illinois has also attempted several reforms, most recently lowering benefits for new employees. But not everyone believes the changes will be good long term. David Merriman is with the Fiscal Futures Project at the University of Illinois. He says the new public pension benefits might be too low for future retirees.
I mean, I think there are trade-offs. They have, I don't know whether you'd say they're going to be good or not. They've solved one problem, but perhaps created others.
Illinois could take a lesson from another state. California, for example, dug itself out of its own fiscal hole.
California used to be known as the poster child for budget dysfunction. Budgets were regularly late, especially at the start of the financial crisis.
That's Tracy Gordon with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. She says California voters took it upon themselves, from lowering the number of votes needed to pass a budget to making its temporary tax hike permanent. California began to see small improvements after those actions, but has also been able to thrive because of its growing tech industry. Illinois, on the other hand, rolled back a temporary tax increase, slowing revenue growth. This summer, a permanent tax hike was approved, but only after the backlog of unpaid bills skyrocketed. And while Illinois is not alone with a lagging economy, experts say there is one thing unique to the state, the political dysfunction. Nancy Hudspeth, who once analyzed the state's finances, says this keeps Illinois from making much headway on current problems or planning for the future.
And what has Illinois done to prepare for that? They're still fighting over things that they were fighting over 10 years ago. And they need to start coming together in a bipartisan way to actually start resolving and making progress on these issues.
She and other analysts think the future is grim. New Jersey, they say, might have a better shot at improvement, leaving Illinois as a state with the worst fiscal health.
I feel sorry. Illinois is great, and it has potential. It shouldn't be like this. It shouldn't be such a dysfunctional place, I guess.
For Illinois Issues, I'm Daisy Contreras.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University. Our website at WGLT.org is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Brian Bloodworth and Laura Kennedy. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag SoundIdeas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 FM, GLT, and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.